And thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is August 5th, 2016. And on today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher, Bruce Rawls. And today, we are diving into Section 2 of the Workbook for Students. Now, last week, if you listened to the show, you know that we listened to excerpts of workshops given by Ken Wapnick, and he was talking about the introduction to Part 2. And if you didn't hear that show, I would really highly recommend that you go back and listen to it. There's still time to do that. You can find it and about 6 months' worth of shows heard live on 1-2 Radio by going to our homepage and clicking on the On Demand link. So that's 1-2radio.com and go to On Demand. Then you find my name in the list of hosts, and then you scroll down to July 29th. That's the one that I'm referring to. But you can also go to any other show that you want to hear. Just click on it, and then you can actually listen from the site, or you can download an MP3 recording. And that's true for all the shows on 1-2 Radio. We've got about 6 months' worth of archive shows sitting there. So if you miss a show, you've got a favorite host or a favorite show, just go and pick it up anytime that you want to, and you can listen. And of course, all of the shows are replayed throughout the week when we don't have live programming, which a lot of times is in the very, very late afternoon or sometimes late at night. You can be listening to encore shows. You might just turn on the radio and just see what's playing and pick up things that way. But for today, Bruce and I will be talking about the first essay that we find in Part 2 of the workbook. And I will admit, you know, as much as I always say this, but I love the workbook, but I love Part 2 because of those essays. Between every 10 lessons, there's going to be an essay like, what is sin? What is forgiveness? And today we're going to start with that, what is forgiveness? And I always kind of laugh and joke because part of me, when I got to that part of the workbook the first time, I thought, why didn't they put that right up front? I mean, you know, didn't we need to know that right away? But, you know, so often, you know, I recognize that there's probably a reason. If I had read some of this stuff in the very beginning, before I ever had any foundation of reading the text or doing the workbook lessons, I probably would have said, ah, this is crazy talk. This is just crazy talk. So I'm sure those essays are in the right place. But I think a lot of people kind of share my feelings once we get to that. And it's so clear. It's just such tight, concise language. Why didn't they just tell us that up front? But it doesn't matter. That's the part of the workbook that we're on now and that we will continue to do throughout the fall and through the end of the workbook. So that's what we're going to do today. And one of the things you can do also while you're listening is you can join us in on Facebook, because we do have a private group over there. And if you'd like to do that, you can make comments or ask questions. And even though I don't respond to those during the show, usually, I can respond afterwards. And I want to assure you that I always read all your comments. So if you'd like to join me and other listeners over there, you can do that by going to our website, 1-2radio.com. And instead of going to the on-demand section that we were talking about before, click the chat button. And when you do, that's going to redirect you to our private group on Facebook, and you can ask to join. And Scott Weaver, our producer today, thanks, Scott, for being here. He'll make sure that you can come into the room and share your comments and ask your questions. So let's get started, and I do want to welcome Bruce, and thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you, CA. It's always a joy to participate in your wonderful show, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you. And of course, I do. I love this part, so I'm anxious to hear what you'll say. And now, did you tell me in an email, I read it a couple of times, did you say that you're in a study group that they read this particular What is Forgiveness at the beginning of every session?
Yes, yes.
Whoa.
So thank you for bringing that up. And a tip of the hat to Beverly Beck of Phoenix, Oregon, and the study group there that I attended for a number of years on Tuesday evenings, and all the other folks there. And it was just a great – because it's only five paragraphs, but there's so much in it. And it really sets the tone, as you pointed out, for the rest of Part 2 as the kickoff idea that really everything ties back into it, just like – the beginning, you know, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, herein lies the peace of God, sets the tone for the whole course, and everything's all holographic anyway. So this is such a pivotal idea, and it was actually almost a decade ago when I first picked up Gary Renard's books that I went back, and it's like I'd kind of set A Course in Miracles aside for the most part for a number of years, and when I read Gary's books, I was like, how could anyone not notice that forgiveness is the crucial idea, you know, in the course? Of course, there's a lot of other synonyms and related ideas to it, but if you had to pick one word that epitomized the practical, hands-on, down in the trenches, day-to-day exercise that we need to do to, in order to be at peace and to really release ourselves from the suffering of the ego's interpretations, forgiveness would be it, wouldn't it? I mean, you can certainly give it other names and in other cultures and other languages. You know, there's probably lots of other synonyms and equivalent ways of saying that. But for us Westerners, English speaking folk, forgiveness is a pretty good word. And I like how A Course in Miracles from so many angles comes at it so that we get the idea that it's not, as Gary Renard's teachers would say, it's not our parents' forgiveness. It's or an Oldsmobile. It's the forgiveness that basically starts from a completely different premise than our ego does, and that's why it works, and that's why it's so easy once we give it a go and actually try. And I think it's kind of fun. I'm kind of rambling a bit here, but it's kind of I like how Jesus in the course comes at that from the perspective of, you know, you might try it and see if it actually works, you know. I'm kind of reminded of the conversation that with Helen of, you know, who was complaining about how difficult the course was and something to that effect, and the response was, well, if you actually tried practicing it, well, here's the practice, you know. But isn't that true? Like anything else, when you put off looking at the things that are they seem more formidable and more challenging than when you actually just dive in and say, okay, now I, you know, a lot of times we wait till we have no other choice, you know, kind of the box canyon effect of the mind okay, well, there's nowhere else to go. I guess I might as well look at this mind stuff, you know. And I think that's kind of how it is with a lot of us, is, you know, we procrastinate and postpone doing the more what seems to be more challenging work of looking at our thoughts. But once we look at them, we see there's nothing there. And I think that's the gentle reminder that's threaded throughout all of A Course in Miracles, that says, you know, this is not a challenging thing. And guess what? That inner kindness teacher is going to do all the heavy lifting. All we have to do is have the little willingness. And I think the will is another word that ties in beautifully to this workbook lesson, because that's the last three words of this first paragraph talks about the will of God. And that really is our will, but we're so accustomed to thinking that we're a separate self that's got a separate will, and then this prodigal facade, you know, fake identity, this fraudulent persona that we've made up and become so identified with. But that's what gives us all our grief. You know, that's where we go out of our way to make ourselves unhappy, isn't it?
Yes. Well, and I'm kind of laughing to myself, your idea that we procrastinate and we just don't do something that needs to be done, because, I mean, this is totally an aside, but it works in perfectly. And that is that I have a guest room with a bathroom and the shower guests. I don't have guests very often, but when I do, several of them have said, boy, the water pressure in that bathroom is really, really poor. And so I'd go in and I'd run the tub and it's like, no, the water pressure is perfect. But what was happening is that because the shower doesn't get used very often, there was a lot of calcium deposits in the actual shower head. But here's the thing. I didn't want to mess with it because, you know, Bruce, every time I've attempted a plumbing job, it turns into a two-day ordeal. You know, I don't care how simple somebody says, oh, you just take this off and plug this up and do this. It's like it's always turned into an ordeal. But now I do have somebody staying with me temporarily, and I just thought, you've got to bite the bullet. toilet and figure out what's going on with the shower. And so, you know, I went in there and just kind of looked at it because I thought first you have to even figure out, you know, what you need or what the part is. And literally, I just put my hand up there and unscrewed it. It came right off. Mm-hmm. And I went, okay, well, that was too that was too easy, Bruce. You know, so I take the shower head to the hardware store and they show me this vast array of other shower heads and say, yeah, you just screw this back on. Mm-hmm. And of course, I kept saying to myself, okay, it can't be this simple. It just can't be, you know. And so, but sure enough, I choose one that looks, you know, like what we want. I bring it home and it's up there in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so, and it's so funny because my guest came out of the bathroom, you know, after using it and she goes, you got a winner. And, you know, I was like, why didn't you do this 6 months ago? Yeah. You know, why did you have to wait? And like you say, in this case, there was no heavy lifting. Uh-huh. And we do the same thing with forgiveness, with looking at our thoughts, looking at our minds. We spend all this time figuring out why we can't do the course, why we can't meditate, why we can't do any of this stuff. And just instead of trying it and going, okay, well, that wasn't so bad, was it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's only in retrospect when we're above the battleground of duality, as the course suggests, that we see, well, there's nothing there. There's it's not only a little deal, it's a no deal. It's, you know, we make it into a big deal by the dread. And I think we also come to dread, you know, if the, you know, cause of death on, you know, everyone's death certificate was, you know, the coroner's report, it was probably dread is it's probably the more accurate, you know, description for most of us, I think.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I want to go back to what you were saying in the very beginning, which, you know, we've said this, but we can't say it enough, which is, you know, when we first use that word forgiveness, it's kind of like the shower, the plumbing thing. You know, we all think we know what forgiveness is. If you Google forgiveness, or if you've been in any church, or if you've just been alive on this planet, I don't care what culture you're in, they've talked about the importance of forgiveness. But the key to A Course in Miracles that comes in the very first sentence of this particular essay says, forgiveness recognizes what you thought your brother did to you has not occurred. Now, that sentence is key because that turns on its head every single thing we have ever thought about forgiveness. Because that's it. I know plumbing and or I know forgiveness and I know how hard it is because I have to struggle to make it okay that this happened to me. And right away they go, no. Forgiveness recognizes that what you thought your brother did to you has not even occurred.
Yes.
So it's like, people, this is a different definition. What we're talking about here is not, as Gary Renard said, this is not your parents' forgiveness. You know, throw out the window everything you think you know about forgiveness, because A Course in Miracles is trying to show us something else.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it continues. It does not pardon sins and make them real. It sees there was no sin. And that's the perspective that we get when we just take a moment and look. And all, we don't have to do anything. It's not about doing. Of course, I think it's good to step back. Like Ken Wapnick says, it's, you can't go very far from the, you know, the metaphysics of the course in order to make it work. You have to keep that in mind. And the metaphysics says that the reality that we are is outside of space and time. And so from that perspective, and it sounds like this lofty ideal, but that's the truth of what we are. And if we can just allow ourselves to tap into that awareness, that very calm, peaceful, composed, gentle awareness that can look with equanimity and kindness on everything in this world and just see it as just a gently forgivable and sometimes laughable joke that we played on ourselves. You know, we thought we pulled off this incredible crime, but nothing happened. The self that we truly are and truly all share has not been compromised in the least. That innocence and that perfection, that stellar radiance that extends to encompass all of creation that we can't even imagine, as is untainted by anything that we could have possibly dreamt in a world of space and time. And so from that perspective, it's obvious, it's simple, but we have to kind of work up to it. We have to, and I think that's where the shared interests come in, is we have to see that we're all in the same boat. We have to, you know, slowly but surely relinquish our idea that there's a we-they thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Paradigm,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and then that, and that, when we realize that we're all together, and all, we're all working through what seem to be two thought systems, one of which is totally insane, and the other of which is totally sane, as Ken points out so eloquently, and we have the decision-making faculty that chooses between those two thought systems, moment to moment to moment. And since we're all doing that, you know, going through that same process, we can afford to be kind-hearted and forgiving, because there's, and from that perspective, from above the battleground, there really is nothing to forgive. But we have to, you know, work up to that by seeing the sameness, by seeing that we're all, you know, working through it together.
Right, because, I mean, you know, sitting here, in fact, I feel somewhat like a hypocrite, because just the other day I was going on and on and on and on about something that somebody had done several years ago that I obviously have not forgotten. And so it's what
none of us have, none of us have ever done that. You're alone in that, CA, right?
Oh yeah. So, you know, we have to work up to it.
Yeah.
It's not as if this automatically go, oh, well, nothing that I think has been done to me has not been done. However, one of the things that helps me, because I've had this experience too, is that I've literally had dreams at night, and something does, you know, something happens in the dream, and I'm pretty angry at the person in the dream who did it. And when I wake up, I still feel angry at them. And I remember one time even just saying, CA, that was in a dream. That did not really happen. You know, so there's no reason to be mad at this person for something that you dreamed two nights ago. And I've had to literally talk myself down out of that. Now, of course, I'm sure a psychologist would say, well, obviously you have some unrelinquished, you know, issues with them, and that's why you projected that. But the point is, I know the difference. I know that that happened in a dream and that it didn't happen to me in reality. But thinking in terms of the same thing that A Course in Miracles keeps saying, you know what, guys, you really are walking around in a dream, and you're unaware of it unless you start looking at your thoughts. Then I can begin to understand in what I think is my real world, well, it's kind of a similar thing.
Yeah.
You're projecting and dreaming that you're being victimized by this person, or that this happened. And someday, in the same way that you wake up from a nighttime dream and realize, oh man, you just made that all up in your head, you're going to realize the same thing about what you think is your real life.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it becomes more ephemeral and more surreal. And ethereal maybe is a better word, one of those E words, the more we look at it gently and see how there's a theme running through it. And the theme really, in truth, is all about forgiveness. It's all about looking at the contents of our minds with that you know, kind-hearted awareness that sees the insanity of the ego. And not in a condemning way, but just as silly. So why would anyone do that? It's kind of like, you know, one of my favorite video clips from Blazing Saddles is when the bad guys are going to go raid the town, and they're all on horseback, and Slim Pickens is leading this band of marauders, right? And they're going through the desert, and all of a sudden they get to this toll gate. And of course, there's miles and miles of just, you know, desert on either side. But because of the path that they're on, they stop in front of this toll gate when all they have to do is just go around.
And go around it.
Right, right. But then then of course, Slim, my I'm going to paraphrase it, but something like, "Damn, now we got to go back and get us a whole shitload of dimes," you know. And that's that whole idea that, you know, we're stumped by something that's just ridiculous. And I think we can laugh at things like that because it's a reflection of the craziness of what we're doing in this movie that we made up that has all these problems that first of all, they're temporary, and secondly, they're just based on an idea that is unfounded. But we don't see that from, you know, because we're so right, our nose is right up against that toll gate, and that's all we can see because we've gotten up so close to it. But if we just back up a foot or two, we see, well, gee, there's, you know, hundreds of miles to the left, hundreds of miles to the right. I could go around this thing instead of having to, you know, bang our heads against it.
Kind of. Well, absolutely. And like, see, once again, you know, these are just gems, these essays here. Yes. And the second paragraph says, an unforgiving thought is one which makes a judgment that it will not raise to doubt, although it's not true. The mind is closed and will not be released. The thought protects projection, tightening its chains so that distortions are more veiled and more obscure. And, you know, where I'm going with that is, as you bring that up, I was thinking in a conversation the other day, I was also talking about, you know, not too surprising, politics. And it's always been really intriguing to me when somebody gets labeled as a flip-flopper, especially when they'll say, well, you know, in 1980 or 1990, they said blah, blah, blah. And I've always said, well, you know what? I'm kind of afraid of somebody who hasn't changed their opinion in 20 years because life changes. And I'm not the same person I was in 1990. I'm not the same person I was in 2015. And it's not that I think we should just constantly be changing our opinions, but as we get new information, as something changes, why would we not change our mind? Mm-hmm. And so when I look at this paragraph, I think, but that's what we do. An unforgiving thought is one that we will not raise to doubt. And that is what we're told in this course over and over. Just look at your thoughts. Why would you not just raise to doubt whether or not this is true? And when we get into that place where we just dig in our heels and we're saying, I'm not going to change my mind, I won't even look at whether or not this is true, that's where we get into trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we don't, the course isn't, it's gently leading us to an awareness of a oneness that is beyond anything we can possibly imagine. But that's too scary. So yeah. all we have to really do is look at when we're not at peace, when we're not feeling an inner mental comfort and raise that to doubt and say, is that necessary? Is it necessary for me to be suffering and miserable, but because of merely just not willing to look at the basis of the thought system that is really the cause of it? And that thought system is an elective. It's a choice. It's something that we can either elect or not elect, speaking of political stuff. And we vote for it, unlike our you know, in this country anyway, the political system where every couple of years we get to go to the ballot box. We're balloting every single second of every single day. And that's incredible power. But it's not the power to change the script. It's the power to change which director's cut we want to listen to.
Right.
On a movie. And that is where the real power lies. And I think the course brings that out in so many ways, is that we're not changing the script. It's not about like the movie The Secret that suggests that all we have to do is look at our minds and mess with it there, and then we can make the world exactly the way we want it. If the circumstances aren't to our liking, we'll just change them. Well, not so much. And maybe, you know, and I think it also kind of alludes to it. And I think, you know, Gary Renard's teachers in his book suggest that, that, you know, maybe the script is written by our collective self, but we're all, you know, complicit in that. We're all contributors to that. So when we get to the point where we're trying to, you know, change what's on the screen, well, that's not terribly effective, but we can change who we watch the movie with. And I love that metaphor that Ken uses so much, Ken Wapnick, and a lot of his work, is that, you know, who we invite to sit with us in the theater. Is it the egos blathering on about how miserable we are, or is it the Holy Spirit, aka the Jesus of the Course, inner kindness teacher, whatever phrase you like, that just takes our hand and it just, you know, laughs gently with us, not at us, but with us, because the self that is watching really is that same self, and we're identifying with the awareness that can be gently amused by how silly it all is to just take offense at you know, at things in the dream on the screen, and make judgments about them, and you know, throwing the Rotten Tomatoes at the screen instead of realizing, hey, that's not going to change what's on coming through the projector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and in the last paragraph, it says, "Do nothing then, and let forgiveness show you what to do through Him who is your guide, your savior, and protector, strong in hope and certain of your ultimate success." And there again, I love that line. I mean, how comforting is that? Mm-hmm. You have a guide and a teacher who not only is always going to show you hope, but also holds out that idea of your ultimate success. Mm-hmm. So no matter how confused you get, how distorted things look, you know, He's always holding out your ultimate success. I mean, how different would our lives be if we really could grasp that idea that at the end of the road is our success?
Right, right.
That's the only thing that's really ever there.
It's inevitable and it's certain and it's a done deal. And,
yes.
And to the ego, those are terrifying words, you know, them's fighting words, because that's what the ego is threatened by, is the inevitability of a peace that's so all-encompassing that there's no reason for its seeming existence anymore. But we don't have to jump to that level. We can just look at the moment-to-moment discomfort that we have and ask ourselves at every moment, am I willing to choose peace instead of this? And I think that's where the word will again comes in, and how important that is with forgiveness is – it basically is suggesting that if we are willing to look, and as the previous paragraph says, you know, forgiveness on the other hand is still and quietly does nothing. It offends no aspect of reality, nor seeks to twist it to appearances it likes. It merely looks and waits and judges not. And that doesn't mean that on the level of form we don't do anything. We just, you know, we don't – it's not like saying, well, you've got to go off and live in a cave and meditate all the time. It's basically just saying on the level of the mind, if we can suspend our judgment and suspend our willingness to jump into the fray and you know, type madly at a political post on Facebook or get into a heated conversation with a family member or a coworker or a friend about X, Y, or Z, in this context of I have a position that needs to be defended. Because if we're coming from a place of defense, that means that there's something separate that needs to be defended from something else.
Right.
And forgiveness, the true forgiveness, the quantum forgiveness, as Gary's teachers suggest, is really coming from a completely different thing. That's where it's, you know, it's our our eternal generation's forgiveness, because it basically is saying that in order to truly forgive, we have to remember, as this first paragraph says, you know, that nothing happened. It did not occur. That the anything in space-time that we're identifying with, that, and that's such a challenging thing, because we're so enamored with our little personal struggle up the mountain with up Everest with all of our gear and the caravans and the tents and the fancy climbing equipment and ropes and ladders and whatever else, and we just hate it when, you know, our inner kindness teacher is just waving to us from that escalator that's environmentally controlled going up the other side of the mountain. And we just happen to glance over that way once in a while. And, you know, it's like, well, why? I could have chosen peace instead of this, you know, this arduous path I've been taking up the mountain. And so it's quietly does nothing. It basically just rides the escalator.
Yeah.
It waits, looks and waits and judges not. In other words, if we're making a big deal out of the things in our space-time dream drama and saying to ourselves, boy, I deserve to be upset. I merit sympathy as a victim. Because after all, I, you know, somebody's doing this to me. Even if it's my own body, you know, it could be mm-hmm. It could be the environment, which is, you know, a nice diffuse thing that's easy to you know, become justified in victimhood with, right? Or it can be even more insidious. It could be my body, and then then do we say, well, I forgive my parents for having sex? You know, yeah. we're all in that boat. You know, so it's like, well, okay, well, how do we get out of that conundrum Well, I think it's because the very premise that nobody wants to look at is that the self that we really are, this awareness, this amazing thing that modern physics, you know, finally had to recognize was, you know, had to be factored in the equation somewhere. They call it consciousness, but the awareness that's beyond the consciousness of duality, I think, is what the Course keeps wanting us to address and to look at. We look from it, I think, is really probably a better way of phrasing it. We look from it at the consciousness of duality that the ego is made up, and we don't try to twist it to appearances that the ego likes. And then it says, he who would not forgive must judge, for he must justify his failure to forgive. And there's where the victimhood comes in. As long as we've got a victim script that's running in the background of our computer, if it's a process that we haven't killed, he's a little nerdy jargon there, you know, because you can, you know, do the analysis, put your mind in a diagnostic mode and see what programs are running, right? You know, under the
right.
And so if we can look and see, oh, well, there's my victim script, and it's got a lot of little threads going, and it keeps bringing, you know, from like Ken Wapnick uses the grab bag as a metaphor. As long as there's something that to be upset about and to be feel a victim of, you know, then forgiveness doesn't make sense. It's because, well, then why would I want to forgive something outside myself? Well, as long as it's outside of yourself, then it's safely, in quotes, out of the realm of the locus of control that is in the mind of the projector. But once we bring it back into our own mind, we realize, well, A, it's not about the other person, and B, it never happened. And I think those are the crucial elements of the quantum forgiveness that this asks us to consider as a helpful practice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then so he who would not forgive must judge, for he must justify his failure to forgive. But he who would forgive himself must learn to welcome truth exactly as it is. And the truth, of course, that this wonderful curriculum reminds us of is the truth that what we are isn't limited at all by the bodies and the personas and all the stuff and all the stories and the history and all the things that we think define us. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just the identification with it that gets us into so much trouble, doesn't it? I mean, that's,
yes.
I think that's where the forgiveness asks us to look at that identification and see how that identification does all kinds of crazy things, like the third paragraph suggests. It says, in frantic action, it pursues its goal, while the goal is to make more stories. And then it says, twisting and overturning what it sees as interfering with its chosen path. Well, the path we chose as ego is to go out on our own, do the John Wayne, I'll do it myself thing. I'll figure it out myself. And that isolationist approach that's divorced from, you know, the rest of creation is doomed at the outset, isn't it? I mean, how could we possibly succeed without the help of, you know, the rest of the cosmos, if you will? And the rest of the cosmos in the mind is available to us all the time. Mm-hmm. The level of form, you know, we're sometimes lucky if we get, you know, you know, two or three people agreeing with this on the level of form. And, you know, it can vary, of course, but the idea is that there's always going to be someone who seems different or thinks different or whatever, that can be seen by the ego's thought system as an adversary. Whereas in truth, if we're all spirit, then what's there to get upset about? What's there to forgive? Because nobody did anything except in a massive dream. So we need to take the seemingly horrific experiences, even if it's just anything from a hangnail to a Holocaust, you know, and anything in between, and look at each one and bring it onto the examination table of the mind with our close encounters light shining down. And then with that intensity of focus, we realize each seeming slight and insult that doesn't seem to merit forgiveness in the dark, when we look at it with that illumination of our inner kindness teacher, it does disappear. It really does. And it's the dread of looking at it that I think that becomes a means of protecting the victimhood and protecting the unforgiveness. And then it continues, distortion is its purpose and the means by which it would accomplish it as well. It sets about its furious attempts to smash reality without concern for anything that would appear to pose a contradiction to its point of view. So that distortion is really anything that we do that says my space and my time and my individuality and my thought system of sin, guilt, and fear are more important than the real alternative, which is the timelessness and spacelessness and inclusiveness, which is, I think, the training wheel idea that gets us back to peace. And the inclusiveness takes the form of shared interests of, you know, looking at things that seem to happen in our world, whether it's something that someone else or some group of people appear to be doing that may not be what we would desire, or if it's something happening on a global or ecological environmental scale, or if it's something happening in our bodies or our finances or whatever, and just look at all that stuff and say, wow, what an elaborate script I've made with the intention, a crazy intention, a crazy will, if you will, pun intended, to want to be a victim, to want to be upset. And the real forgiveness, the only way it works is when our will shifts away from, it's the not know again, the will of the ego that wants us to be miserable. And it sounds crazy when you put it that way. It's like, well, why would anyone want to be miserable? Well, because we think we're getting some kind of mileage out of it. We think we're getting some kind of payoff in terms of, you know, sympathy or, you know, oh, everyone's going to pity my plight kind of thing. Well, okay, so, and then what? All right.
Yeah, because wasn't it Ken Wapnick? I know I've heard Susan Dugan say this. You know, it's sort of like the baby comes in screaming, I'm here, but that it's not my fault.
Right.
And, you know, we continue to make that scream for the rest of our lives is this is not my fault.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And I think we're sort of going backwards, having gone to paragraph 5, but paragraph 2's got a lot of stuff, good stuff in it too. And it really kind of addresses because everything's holographic and it all ties together.
Right.
It says, an unforgiving thought is one which makes a judgment that it will not raise to doubt, although it is not true. The mind is closed and will not be released. Well, that's the infantile, juvenile strategy of the ego. It's me, you know, it's a sociopathic, fanatical, insanity that says I'm more important than the rest of the cosmos. And that's basically what ego boils down to.
Yes.
The thought protects projection, tightening its chain so that distortions are more veiled and more obscure. I mean, it's, if you think of the ego as a propaganda machine,
I mean, which it is.
Which it is. It's incredibly amazing to just watch how, you know, it's no different than what doing a political analysis of the Third Reich and the propaganda that you know, you use fear and you basically convince people that the other is a threat, and then you can justify any number of atrocities. And I think that's, you know, if you look at history and on a political level, you can see that's happened over and over again, you know, and you know, the Nazi, propaganda strategist basically said, you know, you can get anybody to do the bidding if you just convince them that they're under attack and, you know, create an atmosphere of fear and voila. Well, isn't that what the ego does all the time? It's always, oh, I'm afraid that fill in the blanks. And then so the distortions are more veiled and more obscure, less easily accessible to doubt and further kept from reason. Well, that's the first thing that goes out the window is factuality and truth, right? Whenever we go into ego's thought system, we are suddenly under attack. And when you're under attack, your range of resources is constricted severely because you're not thinking in terms of the other person's interest or the other group of people's interest, and when you do that, you've cut yourself off from the principle of inclusion. And I think that's, and we all tend to do that when we listen to that psychobabble of the ego. And it says, and then it finally it says, what can come between a fixed projection and the aim that it has chosen as its wanted goal? Well, the fixed projection, how about the entire material universe? That seems to be a fixed projection, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And yet modern physics suggests that it actually literally disappears and we resurrect it from scratch 10 to the 44th times per second, which is kind of an interesting statistic. It's the approximate value of the Planck's constant, the Planck time constant, that suggests that we're actually in a stroboscopic universe. Does anybody remember the old strobe lights? I built one as a teenager from a kit, and you take the little xenon flash bulb and little oscillator that makes a little pulse, and then it raises the voltage to fire off this little thing, and then it's very fast pulse of light. And obviously you can do the stop motion stuff, and if you turn up the rate of the strobe light, you get all these fun little effects in a darkened room kind of thing. But if you imagine a strobe light where it's completely dark in between these little very, very brief momentary flashes, that's kind of what the universe is doing. And this is a little idea that I picked up from a talk by a lady named Robin McWain, who basically was giving a lecture on modern physics and was saying that essentially what this may be suggesting is that the universe winks out of existence and winks back in about 10 with 44 zeros after it times per second.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But we keep bringing it back the way we, you know, pretty close to the way it was so that we don't freak out. But it's a hologram. As Richard Bach says, we're living in MGM worlds and Warner Brothers lifetimes, you know, and I love that quote because it kind of reminds us this is a colossal movie and we can afford to gently laugh at it when we're above the battleground that forgiveness restores us, you know, restores that position above it so that we can see that all of our judgments are just silly, forgivable. It doesn't seem that way at the time sometimes, but if we can remember to practice on the little things, then sometimes the bigger stuff gets easier if we could just say, oh, this is something I chose to be upset about, but I don't have to put my identity that way. Yeah.
And you know, what I love about a lot of the lines that we have read from this particular essay, that to me, because there again, from that very first start, if I just say to you, okay, knock it off, Bruce, this didn't really happen, mm-hmm. that's not going to be very effective. You know, you're not going to go, oh, okay. But I think what's important and what I watch in myself is this whole idea that if I really start looking at the idea that I have a huge investment in my unforgiving thoughts,
yes.
and yet here it says their only purpose is distortion.
Right.
That's their purpose.
Right.
And you know what I was kind of thinking is, you know, I told you before, I kind of can't help myself. I'm always watching this political stuff, but mostly I record it. And this is what's kind of funny is that, and I have just kind of laughed, but step back. I will record several different shows, you know, and mostly, you know, pseudo news. Let's put it that way. You know, the talk shows. And then I will simply go through, and the minute a guest starts saying something I don't like, I just speed through it. And I have no compunction at all or no judgment that it's like, I don't have to be bipartisan. I don't have to listen to that. I choose not to. But what's kind of funny is I clearly go, okay, you are refusing to listen to something that doesn't agree with what you already think. And the importance here is I'm not saying that I should or should not do that, but the importance is recognizing it, recognizing that when I hold an opinion, I'm not very open to hearing anything that isn't going to corroborate what I already believe and feel. Right. And I think, once again, for me, the problem is when I think I'm being totally neutral, when I think I'm going, okay, give me all the pieces and I'll make a choice. No, I've already made a choice and now I'm only going to listen to the pieces that support it.
Exactly.
And the more we can look at that, not only politically or in the current events, but the more we can just look at that in our life in general and say, you know what, you've pretty much already made an opinion, you've already made a judgment, and you're only allowing in the pieces of quote unquote reality that are going to say, you're right, C.A. Brooks, you're right. And I'm going to just like, you know, I'm going to shut out the rest of it because it just might make me raise my thoughts to doubt, which I don't want to do.
Yeah. And that's really a great analogy because it's that process on a, you know, a physically political level is a perfect example of a subset of what we do on, you know, an esoteric level, if you will, that is not questioning the very basic premise of our existence in form as separate selves. You know, we are so enamored of our identity. We're so invested in our personal wills as little prodigals from something we haven't even, you know, acknowledged as a prodigal journey from perfect oneness most of the time. Because we're so far down the rabbit hole, we've kind of forgotten about that. That's, you know, the seeming trek we've been on, that we don't realize that the very basic assumption of am I a body? Am I a persona that has a body? You know, if you want to step it up a notch. Well, what if what we really all are is an essence or a spirit or an awareness that followed all the way back to the source is the same for everyone and everything? Well, then what? But we don't. Fortunately, we don't get that experience all at once. We actually have convinced ourselves that that would be a horrible thing. And one of the FAQs I was reading on the Foundation for A Course in Miracles website was talking about that. I think it was 1189 or 1190 something. Anyway, it was basically saying, well, why isn't that kind of a scary thing? Well, yeah, to egos it is. But that's only because we painted the idea of peace that surpasses anything we can imagine with its film noir brushstrokes, so that, you know, we've made a monster out of the very thing that we really want, and we were unwilling to look at the horrific nature of the divisive foundation of the ego's underpinnings, because it basically. It would say, well, then why would I want to give up my wars?
Yeah.
all my battles, you know?
Well, and somewhere in the text, I think it's in the text versus the workbook, there's actually a line that says, yes, there actually is a good use for denial.
Right.
And it's to deny all this crap.
Yeah.
I mean,
you
know, when you look at what's going on for yourself and you say, I don't feel peaceful, I don't feel comfortable, I don't feel just, you know, calm and relaxed, then you should start denying the reality of those things.
Right. And that's a really important point. In respect to what you just said, is that is not in any way a suggestion that the Course recommends becoming what Ken Wapnick used to call bliss ninnies.
Right.
Because the whole idea is not to discount or deny the quote unquote factuality of the sensory data. What the Course is suggesting, because it's always and only about the mind, is suggesting is that if we look at the contents of our mind and see where our willfulness and our intention and our desire is to make a big deal out of our interpretations of those sensory experiences, that's where we get into some real interesting turf, because that gives us an opportunity to return to the decision making faculty of the mind that is beyond that narrow definition of self that gets us in so much trouble.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't know if this is the best analogy, but I think about this sometimes. Years ago, a doctor wanted me to take 5 days of a particular drug that I did not want to take. But he said, you know what? We've tried some other things. Let's just try this. 5 days. That's all you have to do it. You don't have to do it anymore. Let's just see if it kind of wipes it out. And so I took the 5 days. However, I also knew one of the side effects is that it makes you think you're hungry all the time. And I mean, at least that's one of the side effects for some people. And 2 days after starting the drug, I woke up in the middle of the night and it was like, I wanted dinner. I mean, I was like, I'm starving. And I had to literally say, CA, this is the drug. This is the drug. Do not believe what you think you're feeling. And, you know, sometimes I think that's maybe where the denial comes in, is that I knew that was the drug. I knew the truth was I was not starving to death. But I'll tell you what, that's what I felt. I felt like I was starving to death. And, you know, like I hadn't eaten in days, and I had to just keep talking myself down and saying, no, this is the drug speaking. This is the drug speaking.
So even though it has been legalized in Colorado, you knew it was just that, right?
I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
But, you know, it was just, like I said, it was just so funny. And I think sometimes though, with the mind or with the course, we have to remember those things. You're right. This isn't about being a bliss ninny. This isn't about, you know, using denial of what's going on, but it is about reinterpreting, which is what I think I was doing, is I was reinterpreting, saying, yes, this is how you feel, but you know where that is coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, your usual interpretation of this feeling is not accurate, and you just have to override your typical usual interpretation of this sensation, because you know what it's really about.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, it was just one of those things that maybe as a metaphysical spiritual lesson, it was worth going through that.
Yeah.
You know, because I can remember it.
And what you were doing is you were looking, as the Course suggests. You were seeing, oh, this is the mechanism that is the chosen path, pursuing its goal, twisting and overturning as seeing what is interfering, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that the chosen goal, of course, is to stay in denial and to not notice the thought system that basically says, I need, I lack, I want.
Right.
And I don't have, you know? And so I think that's where, you know, the fulfillment of A Course in Miracles comes in, when we have those moments of peace, when we look at that and we realize, I don't have to identify with neediness and lack and want. Now, obviously,
exactly.
on the level of form, there may be things that you legitimately need and want. And, oxygen's one that I think I actually need, you know, and water fairly frequently, things like that. But at the same time, again, if it's never about anything but the mind in A Course in Miracles, then we have to get back to, well, okay, what do I as a spirit need? What do I as an essence, an individuality that is beyond individuality, you know? And we can't even really go there much, but because it's such an abstract idea. But the quality of peace that I think is possible when we are willing to look at the ego and say, I don't know what I really am, but I know that this who that I think I am isn't working.
That's right.
And that who is just insane when we look at it. It's like going to the bottom of the mountain and The Hobbit, you know, or in The Lord of the Rings, and seeing this Gollum character, the Smeagol, and it's like, wow, what a crazy creature this is. And it wants to stay invisible, and the whole story centers around its invisibility, this ring that makes it invisible, because it does not want to be looked at. And it will frantically pursue anything to get that ring back. Because as long as we're not looking at it, as long as we're staying in the dark, then that's fine. As long as we want to look at all the nice metaphysical ideas and of course language and yada yada, anything, as long as it's not done from a truly mindful place that includes that inner kindness teacher that then flicks on that Close Encounters intensity light, and suddenly not only is there no monsters, there's no hideous creature, but it's just gone. And that's what our egos are afraid of, is seeing that there is no Gollum, there's no Smeagol, there's no ring, there's nothing there. And we see its falsity and we let it go.
Yes.
And then what's – go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and on that note though, what we do have is a producer. And that producer is going to be saying, CA, are you looking at the clock?
Oh.
We're getting to the end of the show.
Okay.
And so on that note, I mean, that was a great place. I would love to talk about that more. But we are at the end of the show today, Bruce. And I just want to say thank you so much. Do you have any quick announcements you'd like to make before we wrap up?
Sure. Thank you, Sia. I think I'm going to mention that last time I'm participating again for the third year in the Miracle Share virtual conference in October. And that's a virtual, of course, a Miracle conference for over 3 days. And if you can't attend in person, that's fine because it's virtual. And if you happen to have that weekend booked, that's not a problem either because it's recorded and you can listen to it throughout the year, anytime you want. So if you go to aciandblog.com, in the upper left corner, there's a link to that. And I also post other things of interest. And I also always like to remind people to check out all the wonderful resources and the two sister organizations, Foundation for A Course in Miracles, facim.org, and of course, the original publisher of A Course in Miracles, acim.org, for the Foundation for Inner Peace. So thank you again, and always a joy to be on your show.
Okay, well, Bruce, thank you so much. And everybody, thanks for being here. And thanks to our producer, Scott Weaver, today. And I hope you will all stick around because up next is Kathleen Peterson and Friends on Fabulous Fridays here on 1-2 Radio. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about forgiveness.